Ladies and gentlemen, there is a man-made force thousands of times greater than the hydrogen bomb. It's an instrument of many parts, small, can fit into a handbag. Yet it has the power to penetrate to every area of human life. Details may be found in document A-777.
United Nations Radio, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents document A-777, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin, with the participation of the following international cast of stars of film, stage, and radio: Richard Basehart, Charles Boyer, Lee Day Cobb, Ronald Coleman, Joan Crawford, Morris Evans, Jose Ferrer, Reginald Gardner, Van Heflin, Jean Hersholt, Lena Horne, Marsha Hunt, Alexander Knox, Charles Lawton, Sir Lawrence Olivier, Vincent Price, Edward G. Robinson, Robert Ryan, Hilda Vaughn, Emily Williams, and Robert Young. Music is composed and conducted by Lynn Murray. Document A-777.
Have a rendezvous on an island 20 miles outside New York City. You drive up to a parking lot near a huge plant next to a bombsite factory. You leave your car and meet the contact who's going to put you in touch with document A-777. Together you walk toward the main entrance. On your way, you quietly ask a few questions.
What is the striking area of this force?
Vastly greater than the H-bomb.
I see. What is the pressure at the center?
The conscience of mankind.
Maybe he can't talk now. You follow him through wide doors into a wide corridor. You come to a little bookstore off the corridor. Together you go in and approach a young girl. Her face betrays no emotion. She could be a clerk in any bookstore.
Yes, sir.
Document A-777, please.
Certainly.
She moves swiftly to a counter, picks up a small pamphlet, and returns with it.
10 cents, please.
He pays her 10 cents and turns over the pamphlet to you. You read what it says on the cover.
The Declaration of Human Rights. You mean this,
Read what it says inside the cover.
You come to italicized type.
On December 10, 1948... the United Nations adopted and proclaimed the Universal Declaration of Human...
Below that.
Oh. This is the authorized text as contained in the official records of the third session of the General Assembly, document A-777.
Well, there it is.
And this is what you mean by a force greater than the hydrogen bomb?
Well, if you take the trouble to examine the text, you'll see that the ideas set forth in the declaration could, if supported by every country in the world, lead to a situation where...
But your eye has already caught the word preamble, and under it, document A-777 begins to explain itself.
Whereas, recognition of the inherent dignity of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights...
Sure, that's the way it is in radio. Catch the listener on a fishhook dangled in air, a bright spinner of music, an angle of urgency in the voice, a promise of bombs and spies and secret rendezvous. But it is true, that bulletin cast in the stream.
A force thousands of times greater than the hydrogen bomb.
It's true enough if you look at that claim not as a fish at a fly or a fly at a fish, but as a man looking at a world of human beings more or less like himself. Declaration of Human Rights. 30 short articles. Before the first article appear 7 whereases, 1 now therefore, and at least 5 millenniums of struggle and violence. For in a sense, this program took 5,000 years to prepare. The story of human rights began shortly after the first tenets appeared in the Garden of Eden. But for practical purposes, we pick up the narrative considerably later, on a night in December, 1948, just 15 months ago. It's getting on toward midnight. A fog spreads over the city, shrouding the Seine, swallowing monuments, paling the lights of the Place de la Concorde. Paris is asleep, its theaters and restaurants shut down, its subway trains making their last run before gates close. Only nightclubs and the United Nations are still open. In the brand new Palais de Chaillot, 50 nations are at work on a launching. After 2 years of meetings, coursing down a long, winding river of debate, after hundreds of amendments and 1,000 statements, the time of decision has come. The president of the Third General Assembly of the United Nations leans forward, speaks into a microphone.
Vote is now on the declaration as a whole.
Now the roll call begins. Country by country, approval or opposition will be expressed by the famously brief words, yes or no. Some countries may neither approve nor oppose. These will answer abstain. But all of the countries, whether yes, no, or abstain, have already contributed through conference and debate to the cluster of articles being voted on. So here it is coming up. 2 billion people have a stake in this. For the first time anywhere on the face of the earth, human rights for all the peoples of the world stand for a vote.
Afghanistan?
Yes.
Argentina?
Si.
Australia?
Wait. Hold the roll call. This is the birth of a Bill of Rights, whose first article speaks of birth itself.
Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights.
Australia?
Yes.
Belgium?
Oui.
Bolivia?
Bolivia. Step away from the meeting for a moment and look behind you. Look as far behind as the year 1780, when Bolivia was still a part of Peru. Go back to a dusty village, to a prison in the village, to a cell in the prison. Tupac Amaru, an Inca, descended of royal blood, lies chained in the cell for leading a rebellion against the Spanish occupation. A commandant arrives, stands for a moment outside the cell door, looks down his Castilian nose at the prisoner, then goes in, leaving the door ajar.
One last time, Indian. Who are your accomplices? Who are the other conspirators?
The only conspirators are you and myself. You for oppressing the country and I for trying to liberate it.
I see, one of the clever ones. Oh, when will your kind learn to behave?
One of your kind beheaded my ancestor in Cusco 200 years ago. If we haven't learned to behave in 200 years, I can promise you we never will.
I find you tiresome. But as you seem to enjoy a show of unbroken spirit, you may be interested to know what's intended for you.
I can imagine. Don't bother.
Oh, it's no bother. On the contrary, it's a pleasure. Well, there is the matter first of ripping out your tongue. Then for you and your colleagues, an iron collar. In the middle, I'm afraid, there will be 3 sharp spikes, red hot, which, under pressure, will come out through your mouth, Somehow I have an idea that you won't take the affair so coolly at that point. Well, shall I go on? In whatever condition you may be after this, experience, you will then be put on public show for a whole day. After that, you'll be drawn and quartered, and your remains scattered to dogs outside the city.
Rather dead among dogs than living among you Spaniards.
Yes, yes, of course, of course. Ah, well. Well, a very good night to you. What little remains of it. Oh, and one other thing. I have the honor to tell you that along with the 40 captains and the men in prison, they will be hanged before your eyes, your wife and children.
Not fiction. Nothing in this program is fiction. Tupac Amaru in Bolivia, before and after him, thousands of men like him tortured in other countries for other causes at other times, right up through Germany, 1945, all of which document A777 takes into account.
Article 5. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment.
Bolivia?
Si.
Brazil?
Si.
Burma?
Yes.
Bielorussia?
Abstain.
Canada?
Yes.
Chile?
Si.
China?
Stop for China. Go back to a time 200 years before Christ. The time of the Emperor Shu Wangdi, warrior, conqueror, builder of the Great Wall. He's tough, brilliant, powerful, and vain. He thinks so highly of his own regime that he doesn't want it compared with anything that ever went before. Between Shu's Great Wall and the distant sea sprawls a nation already ancient in the arts, a people who have inherited, among other things, the freedom to think and speak. One day in the year 213 B.C., in a tea house in Shensi province, a young scholar rises to recite a poem that is already 300 years old. He's among friends who enjoy the old and common Chinese custom of writing, speaking, listening to poetry.
The locust's wings say throng, throng. Well may your sons and grandsons be a host innumerable. The locust's wings say, join, join. Well may your sons and grandsons be forever at one. The locust's wings...
Stop! Stop, I say.
What's the matter? What are you doing?
You're under arrest, violating the imperial edict.
What imperial edict?
The order that all people who recite poetry are to be executed.
But that's ridiculous.
Yes, exactly. Too many of you scholars think the emperor's laws are ridiculous. Come along.
Just a moment. Take your hands off of me. I refuse to believe that any such stupid and vicious order exists under the imperial seal. You will either produce such an order or...
You will not threaten one of His Majesty's officers. And I caution the rest of you to stand back. Since you have apparently not heard of the decree of the Grand Counselor, though ignorance of the law does not in any case reduce your crime, I will read it to you. Whereas scholars, instead of learning the present laws, are studying ancient dynasties, and as a result seeking to criticize by comparison the present government and poison the minds of the people. Therefore, 1. All historical records, save those of the present dynasty, will be burned.
Burn the records?
2. All libraries of literature and philosophy, except those under the custody of the imperial doctors, will be destroyed.
Preposterous!
All people who recite poetry or discuss history will be executed. 4. All those who raise their voices against the present government in the name of antiquity will be beheaded, together with their families.
And the scholar of the locust wings was buried alive, along with 459 others in the same year.
Article 19. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. Freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas.
China?
Yes.
Colombia?
Si.
Costa Rica?
Yes.
Cuba?
Si.
Czechoslovakia?
Abstain.
Denmark?
Yes.
Dominican Republic?
Yes.
Ecuador?
Si.
Egypt?
Wait. Spin the globe in reverse until you're back 3,500 years. Back to a time when the Great Pyramids had been standing for only a handful of centuries.
When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go.
Oppression is a burden heavier than mountains, and only a great force can lift it. Sometimes revolution, sometimes war, sometimes even the striking of the firstborn dead. When Israel was in Egypt's land, it took the wrath of Jehovah himself to pry the people free of oppression.
Let my people go.
The Bible itself bears witness.
Thus saith the Lord, let my people go.
And the people were let go. And 3,000 years after them, another people, also oppressed so hard they could not stand, identified themselves with the ancient Israelites of Egypt's land. Out of a new bondage, half a world removed from where they were born, out of the anguish of their suffering, great spirituals of freedom came welling up. And again, song, as so many times before and since, spoke on the side of human rights, crying this time for the right of a man to get up and go.
Let my people go.
Article 13. Everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own.
Egypt?
Yes.
El Salvador?
Si.
Ethiopia?
Oui.
France?
France, the country outside the walls of this palais, the country of painters, poets, and champagnes, lately occupied by the enemies of every human right. France, with all its pageantry of kings and queens and guillotines, its Joan at the stake, its headstrong emperors, its religious massacres, its Voltaire, its own bold declaration of the rights of man. As in other countries on and beyond her borders, France has many a wronged right to explain to the God of nations on Judgment Day, but also she has many a righted wrong. And none more stirring than the righting of the wrong done to an obscure army captain. Framed, smeared, convicted, disgraced, exiled, and innocent. Such was the victim. And in a time of cowardice and treachery, when even in the face of new evidence, the press violently opposed recalling the convict from Devil's Island, one newspaper had the courage to speak out. And it spoke with a thunderous voice of Emile Zola.
Of the judicial error, and having afterwards continued to defend his deadly work by machinations as ridiculous as they are guilty. I accuse General Mercier of having made himself an accomplice in one of the greatest crimes of history. I accuse General Billot of having had in his hands the decisive proofs of the innocence of Dreyfus, and of having concealed them out of political motives. I accuse the War Office of having led a vile campaign in the press in order to misdirect public opinion and cover up its sins. I accuse, lastly, the first court-martial of having violated all human rights in condemning a prisoner on testimony kept secret from him. In making these accusations, I am aware that I render myself liable to laws which punish acts of defamation. I expose myself voluntarily. As to the men I accuse, I do not know them. I have never seen them. I feel neither resentment nor hatred against them. I have one passion only, for light, in the name of humanity, which has borne so much and has a right to happiness. Mr. President, I beg you to accept the assurances of my deepest...
As the world well knows, he won. Won after being himself slandered, tried, convicted of libel for those accusations. Years later, when the thunder was stilled, when Zola lay dead in state in the Pantheon, with Dreyfus free among the mourners, the gifted Anatole France stood above the coffin and reminded his nation of one man's struggle for the rights of another.
Look upon him. He has honored his country and the world. Look upon him. He was a moment of the conscience of mankind.
Article 10. Everyone is entitled to a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal.
France?
Oui.
Greece?
Yes.
Guatemala?
Si.
Haiti?
Oui.
Honduras?
Honduras?
Absent. Iceland?
Yes.
India?
Hold it. Look below there. Notice the little white-haired woman sitting among the Indian representatives of this General Assembly here in the Palais du Chaillot in Paris. That is Mrs. Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit, chairman of her nation's delegation. A woman. Bear this in mind, because...
India?
Please, hold it. History's been long enough at the job in India to permit a few moments of reminiscence here. Remember, a woman chairing India's group at the United Nations... Now fan through the pages of India's past, through the tortured millenniums of this massive subcontinent, past the wars, the mutinies, the famines, the droughts, the floods, all the way back to ancient law. Listen now to the duties. Mark the position of woman as prescribed in the early ordinances.
One should not eat with his wife, nor look at her eating, sneezing, yawning, or sitting at her ease. No act is to be done according to her will by a young girl, a young woman, or even by an old woman, though in their own houses. The good wife of a husband, be he living or dead, must never do anything disagreeable to him. But she may, at will, when he is dead, emaciate her body. She may not, however, when her husband is dead, mention even the name of another man. She must be, till death, subdued, intent, chaste. A man may marry again.
Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration, without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex.
India?
Yes.
Iran?
Yes.
Iraq?
Yes.
Lebanon?
Yes.
Liberia?
Liberia. What a bright title for a country. Liberia for liberty. Yet north and south of its palmy shores, in times not so remote, the export of these parts was just the opposite of liberty. It was the marketable, perishable commodity of enslaved human beings. The trade flourished along this coast. There was money in it, as there is today in cattle. It actually was figured in percentages.
Exclusive of the slaves who died before they sailed from Africa, 12.5% were lost during the passage to the West Indies. At Jamaica, 4.5% died whilst in the harbors or before the sale, and 1/3 more in the seasoning. Thus, out of every lot of 100 shipped from Africa, 17 died in about 9 weeks. Not more than 50 lived to be effective laborers on the island.
The seasoning. 1/3 more died in the seasoning. What seasoning meant only a slave could know. Once, across the continent from Liberia, out in the Indian Ocean, a Briton named Trelawney, adventurer, pirate, later to be the friend of Byron and Shelley, landed on the island of Mauritius. No South Sea island has ever had a better billing. It was called
a fairy island, conjured up out of the sea by a genie for the delight of mankind.
Now, this Trelawney was no dilettante. He was as tough as a bull. He'd killed scores of men in brawls and battles with knives, bullets, and his naked hands. He was hardly the one to squirm at the sight of blood. Yet listen to what he has to say on seeing the treatment of slaves on that very island conjured up for the delight of mankind.
I saw them lash the bare and festered back of an overloaded female slave. Her tender nature one animated mass of ulcers and cancers, half consumed alive by flies and maggots. Death her only hope. I've seen men with their spines knotted like pine trees and their skins as scaled and callous. The flesh cracked into chasms from which the blood oozed out like gum. The pity and pain I felt at the sight of these poor slaves could only be equaled by the deep and overwhelming damnation I invoked on the heads of their oppressors forever. Surely such monsters are annihilated. They cannot be immortal. Yet they should have an eternity to torture them. What they have done to others should be done to them. And I defy the invention of hell's demons to be more cunning in cruelty than themselves.
Article 4. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms.
Liberia?
Yes.
Luxembourg?
Yes.
Mexico?
Si.
Netherlands?
Yes.
New Zealand?
Now, how do you suppose modest, quiet New Zealand is going to vote? New Zealand, down there toward the South Pole, out of the way of everything but the weather. What would a remote dominion in the Tasman Sea know about human rights? Well, here is the number one citizen of New Zealand to answer that, the Prime Minister, Sidney G. Holland, specially addressing this program by shortwave.
It is a matter of pride to every New Zealander that this country, one of the youngest in the world, was the first to give women the right to vote, the first to give an old age pension to its citizens, and among the first to introduce a full system of social security and benefits for widows, orphans, and the sick.
Article 21. Periodic and genuine elections by universal and equal suffrage. Article 22. Everyone, as a member of society, has the right to social security. Article 25. Everyone has the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control.
New Zealand?
Yes.
Nicaragua?
Yes.
Norway?
Yes.
Pakistan?
Yes.
Panama?
Yes.
Paraguay?
Paraguay. 88 years ago, Asuncion, the capital city, night. Down the street rides a man on horseback. He's Francisco Solano Lopez, whose father, the first president of the republic, has just died. On both sides of the street, long aisles of men stand at attention. His guard of honor. This man on a horse is one of the big I ams of history, one of the supreme fatheads whom circumstance, accident, and fate too often thrust into power. Because of this fellow, not a single soldier in these long ranks of silent Paraguayans will be alive 7 years from this moment. The short, stocky, strutting peacock, an ardent admirer of Napoleon, rides up now to a woman sitting on horseback awaiting him. This is his mistress, Madame Eliza Lynch. El Supremo Lopez reins his horse and stops in front of her.
Madame, I am Paraguay.
Long live the Emperor.
Emperor? He's the son of a president who's just died, that's all. Nobody elected him to be anything. But that doesn't matter. Nothing matters when you're dealing with his species. In almost every country, at some time or another, despots of this sort have risen, held sway, and been put down at great inconvenience, either by their own countrymen or by other countries' men, or by both.
Madame, I am Paraguay.
Alexander the Great, for example. When Darius offered to share the Persian Empire with him, the young Macedonian said modestly,
"Heaven cannot support two sons, nor earth two masters."
France had its share. King Louis XIV announcing to one of his boys,
"I am the state."
Russia, too, was well represented. Ivan the Terrible had this to say.
"The sovereign is above the empire. No Russian sovereign has ever given an account of his actions to anyone on earth."
And somewhat further along, here is Napoleon Bonaparte speaking to the Austrian statesman Metternich.
"I was brought up on the battlefield. A man like me does not concern much about the lives of a million men."
But back to Francisco Solano Lopez, the great I am of Paraguay. He is breakfasting with his mistress on a day in the fourth year of a war he started against three neighboring countries. An orderly arrives with the message that one of Paraguay's forts, Umate, has been surrendered by Colonel Martinez after a long battle against crushing odds. Lopez receives the news with a sweeping gesture.
"Francisco! Francisco, what are you doing?"
"The swine. The man has surrendered Umate."
"But didn't you expect that? You sent him no reinforcements. You sent
Shut
nothing.
Shut up! I'm going to arrest the wife of that yellow, gutless Martinez. Before I'm through with her, she'll be something no traitor will ever forget."
"You call Martinez a traitor? He defended that fort for months, and bravely. And even if he did give in, how can you blame his wife?"
"When a country is fighting for its life, cowardice is a knife in the back. I'll see to it the name of Martinez is drenched in blood."
"But not his wife's blood. Francisco, you can't do this to an innocent woman."
"Don't tell me what I can't do. Her husband handed a fort of mine to the enemy. He surrendered 2,000 of my men, do you hear?"
"But she didn't surrender. For God's sake, have some pity."
"Pity? I'll make her an example for all of Paraguay. No officer of mine who has a wife or sister or mother will surrender any of my men after they see what I do to her."
"You will do nothing to her. You've done more to people than I care to remember. But you're not going to kill that woman."
Promptly the next morning, the wife of Colonel Martinez, who had not seen her husband for a year, was stood up before a watching army and flogged to death. And the lash was kept busy in Asuncion, falling impartially on men and women. Even Francisco Lopez's own mother, his 60-year-old mother, was flogged at the order of her son, having been charged with conspiracy. And his two sisters, the whip fell on them as well. And his brother, Benigno, whom he had put to death after a brutal flogging. And thanks to El Supremo, the senseless war of vanity and ambition dragged on. Men of 60 and boys of 12 were drafted into the army. Women dug trenches and carried ammunition. The Supreme One ordered his soldiers to massacre all the wounded on the battlefield, his own as well as the enemy's. At the start of this madness, Paraguay had the population of 1,300,000. At the end, only 200,000. 11 out of every 13 people in the country were dead of a single man's ambition, of a despot's will.
Madame, I am Paraguay.
Article 21. The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government.
Paraguay?
Si.
Peru?
Si.
Philippines?
Yes.
Poland?
Abstain.
Saudi Arabia?
Abstain.
Siam?
Yes.
Sweden?
Sweden. Even Sweden. Comb the continents and the islands, anatomize the history of humankind, and there'll turn up very few times and territories where injustice has not done its work. Sweden, then. 1723. A country road. A man walking down the road is overtaken by an officer of the crown.
You there!
Yes, sir.
Let me see your certificate.
What certificate?
Showing that you attend services and receive instruction in the Christian faith.
I didn't know I had to have one. When did this law...
Act of Parliament. Are you a thread maker?
No, sir.
You a hook and eye maker?
No.
You a vagabond?
Well, certainly not.
Are you a Jew?
No, sir. I'm a...
Gypsy?
No, heavens, no. I'm a Christian. I'm from Sigtuna. I go to church regularly. I use all the prescribed means to be saved.
Ah, well, you look to me like a good Swede. Therefore, I'll take your name and let you go, but see that you get a certificate from your parson immediately.
Yes, sir.
Otherwise, you're liable to be seized, put to public work. This is done to all inferior types until they show a serious desire to be instructed in the knowledge of God.
Yes, and well, they should be, especially the Jews and the gypsies.
Gypsies we now exile altogether. As for Jews, Parliament is going to take even sterner measures with them.
Good. The sooner the better.
And now your name.
Including the Scandinavian, even Sweden at one time picked on the wandering scapegoat who for 2,000 years was scattered in every clime and under every flag except his own. Babylon, Jericho, and Persia, Greece and Rome and the dispersion, Spain, Russia, England, Poland, pogrom, ghetto, Inquisition, Haman and Hitler, the rack and the gas chamber. All too well, these people who were let out of Egypt land knew what it was to be deprived of human rights, of every human right, even in Sweden.
Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms without distinction of any kind, such as race, religion, national origin, property, birth. Article 15. Everyone has the right to a nationality. Article 18. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion.
Turkey?
Yes.
Ukraine?
Abstain.
South Africa?
Abstain.
Soviet Union?
Abstain.
United Kingdom?
United Kingdom. Tight, little, stubborn, sceptered isles that alone stood off the fascinator of the masses, together with his Luftwaffe, his intuition, and his allies. And just as the blitz on London has dissolved in the slipstream of time and is already 10 years past us, so the longer and equally gallant struggle for human right recedes past the Magna Carta, past the Dark Ages, past the Roman massacres, back to the dimmest beginning of English history. And nowhere such a breed of giants ranged on the side of the rights of man. Milton, Tennyson, Keats, Byron, Shelley, Wordsworth, Wells, Shaw, and, of course, the genius of geniuses, the butcher's son from Stratford. In Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare took up an injustice that was almost universal. Midway in the tragedy, we come upon Lord and Lady Capulet reprimanding their daughter Juliet for failing to appreciate a noble gentleman named Paris, whom they have picked to be her husband. Capulet speaks to his wife in front of the girl.
How now, wife? Have you delivered to her our decree?
Aye, sir. But she will none. She gives you thanks. I would the fool were married to her grave.
How? She will none. Doth she give us thanks? Is she not proud? Doth she not count her blessed, unworthy as she is, that we have wrought so worthy a gentleman to be her bridegroom?
Not proud you have, but thankful that you have. Proud I can never be of what I hate. But thankful even for hate that is meant love.
How, chop logic, what is this? Proud, and I thank you not, and yet not proud. Mistress Minion, you'll thank me no thankings, nor proud me no prouds. But fettle your fine joints against Thursday next to go with Paris to St. Peter's Church, or I will drag thee on a hurdle thither. Out your green sickness, carry on, out your baggage.
Fie, what, are you mad?
Good father, I beseech you on my knees. Hear me with patience, but to speak a word.
Hang the young bed, you disobedient wretch. I tell thee what, get thee to church of Thursday or never after look me in the face. Speak not, reply not, do not answer me. Oh, my fingers itch. Wife, we scarcely thought us blessed that God hath lent us but this only child. But now I see this one is one too much.
You are too hot.
God's bread, it makes me mad. Day, night, hour, time, work, play, alone, in company, still my care hath been to have her matched. And having now provided a gentleman of noble parentage, of fair demeans, youthful and nobly trained, and then to have a wretched, puling fool to answer, I'll not wed, I cannot love, I am too young, I pray you pardon me. But an you will not wed, I'll pardon you. Graze where you will, you shall not house with me. Thursday is near, lay hand on heart, advise. And you be mine, I'll give you to my friend. And you be not, hang, beg, starve, die in the streets. For by my soul, I'll ne'er acknowledge thee.
Is there no pity sitting in the clouds that sees into the bottom of my grief? Oh, sweet my mother, cast me not away. Delay this marriage for a month, a week. Or, if you do not, make the bridal bed in that dim monument where Tybalt lies.
Talk not to me, for I'll not speak a word. Do as thou wilt, for I have done with thee.
Article 16. Marriage shall be entered into only with the free and full consent of the intending spouses.
But every age and every country has its Capulets, its Francisco Lopez, its quota of contempt for human blood or human rights. In this same England, Baron de Mandeville, a man of wit and charm, whom Benjamin Franklin once met and called the life of the party, came up with a formula for making wealth. It was simple.
In my view, the surest wealth consists in a multitude of laborious poor. To make society happy and people easy, it is requisite that great numbers of them be ignorant as well as poor. I'm convinced the knowledge of the working poor should be confined within their occupations. The more a shepherd, for instance, or a ploughman, or any other peasant knows of the world, why, the less fit he'll be to go through the fatigues and hardships of it with cheerfulness and content.
Article 26. Everyone has the right to education. Elementary education shall be compulsory. Higher education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit.
Notwithstanding the de Mandevilles, there was a ceaseless fight for betterment of the workers' lot in England. The people of Britain themselves did the bitterest fighting, but they were helped sometimes by men of high position. Listen to Lord Byron, the poet, the aristocrat addressing the House of Lords, speaking against a bill to punish by death the destruction of machinery by jobless workers.
These men never destroyed their looms till they were become useless. These men were willing to dig, but the spade was in other hands. Their means of subsistence were cut off, all other employments preoccupied, and their excesses however to be deplored or condemned, can hardly be the matter of surprise. And what are your remedies? After months of inaction, at length comes forth the grand specific, the never-failing nostrum of all state physicians. After feeling the pulse and shaking your head over the patient, you decide these convulsions must terminate in death. Is there not blood enough upon your penal code? Can you commit a whole country to their own prisons? Are these the remedies for a starving and desperate populace? When a proposal is made to emancipate or relieve, you hesitate. You deliberate for years. You temporize and tamper with the minds of men. But a death bill must be passed offhand.
Article 23. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment.
United Kingdom?
Yes.
United States?
The United States of America. First country in the world to produce a constitutional guarantee of freedom. First to call it by its proper name.
Bill of Rights.
Take a moment here in the assembly hall in Paris and look down there. See that tall woman sitting among the American delegation here in the assembly? That woman is the chairman of the UN's Commission on Human Rights, the group which has framed the very articles now being voted on. She's the widow of a president of the United States. The 31st. All right. Take your eyes off the meeting now and fade back with us, back to the time of the third president of the United States, Jefferson, a man who has always had a passionate concern for men's rights. It was he who wrote the Declaration of Independence, who introduced a plan for the gradual emancipation of slaves. He who battled for the Bill of Rights itself. All who personally knew Tom Jefferson agree that he's sweet-tempered, honest, frank, and dedicated to his country. Also that he's a highly moral man. Hear him on that.
I am a Christian in the only sense in which Jesus wished anyone to be. I am sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others.
Unquestionably, this president, so respectful of the rights of all men, is honored and respected by all men. Listen to these tributes from all quarters of the Republic. Here is a Mr. William Smith of South Carolina writing in the press.
Mr. Jefferson's political principles are subversive.
And the Reverend Mr. Parrish of Boston in the course of the Thanksgiving sermon.
It is our misfortune to live in an age when the chief magistrate of the nation has wantonly assaulted the religion of our fathers, a baleful influence.
And the portfolio, a smear sheet published in Philadelphia.
We protest the reading of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. It is a false and flatulent and foolish paper written by a man of unskilled style and of questionable honesty.
A minister in Southington, Connecticut.
The president is a debauchee, an infidel, a liar.
The New England Palladium warning the people of what will happen under Jefferson's administration.
The seal of death will be set on our holy religion. Our churches will be prostrated, and some famous prostitute, under the title of the Goddess of Reason, will preside in the sanctuaries now devoted to the worship of the Most High.
Some of Jefferson's appointees are hounded as subversive, as disloyal, unfit to work in the manufacture of war materials. And a toast is proposed to the president at a banquet of Federalists in Middletown, Connecticut.
May he receive from his fellow citizens the reward of his merit. A noose!
Article 12. No one shall be subjected to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such attacks.
Music. The people of the young United States thought better of this champion of their rights than did those sections of the press and clergy. The people twice elected him to the highest office. And from the day Jefferson died to this one, his name is revered across his country. His face is on the stamps and coins of America. They are his 100 million daily memorials. From Jefferson onward, a constant, gallant, sometimes bloody fight to preserve human rights. Not even stopping at civil war. And through it all, the people, the artists, the great leaders, lining up on the side of the individual and his rights. Playwrights, poets, Longfellow, Whittier, Emerson, Thoreau, Walt Whitman.
This America is only you and me. Its power, weapons, testimony are you and me. The officers, capitals, armies, ships are you and me. Past, present, future are you and me. I swear nothing is good to me now that ignores individuals. The American compact is altogether with individuals. The whole theory of the universe is directed unerringly to one single individual, namely to you.
Whereas the peoples of the United Nations have in the Charter reaffirmed their faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person.
United States?
Yes.
Uruguay?
Si.
Venezuela?
Si.
Yemen? Yemen?
Absent.
Yugoslavia?
Abstain.
The roll call is completed. The vote?
In favor of adoption, 48. Against adoption, none. Abstentions, 8. So that we reach the stage, gentlemen, in which by an enormous vote and without any direct opposition, this assembly has adopted this very important declaration.
Without any direct opposition, he says. Some countries have abstained because they think the declaration goes too far. Others because they don't think it's gone far enough. But no direct opposition. No no's, non's, nays, or nyets. Now the president of the assembly makes a little speech reminding the nations that though this declaration of human rights does not yet have the force of law, it is the all-important first step toward that end. Here is Evatt of Australia speaking at the Palais in Paris. At the end of a long day, the clock now reading almost midnight.
Nor does it provide for enforcement. Still, it is the first step in a great evolutionary process. It is the first occasion on which the organized community of nations has made a declaration of human rights and fundamental freedoms, and it has the authority of the body of opinion of the United Nations as a whole. And millions of people, men and women and children all over the world, many miles from Paris and New York, will turn for hope and guidance and inspiration to this document. And I must congratulate...
It's midnight now in foggy Paris, and the bells of the nearby Notre Dame de Grâce de Passy strike the hour. And as the sound pulses toward the outskirts of Chaillot, so do the mighty overtones of document A777. Radiating from the city of Voltaire, the first vibrations of world conscience, eastward from Paris over the freezing heartland of Europe, down the plains of Asia, out into the Pacific.
Everyone, without distinction of any kind.
Westward from Paris over farms and villages, past the stormy channel, out across the Atlantic, all the way to the New World, to the City of Towers, through its griddle of streets and avenues, shimmering magnetically over the very ground where America's Bill of Rights was composed.
Free and equal in dignity and rights.
Inundating the byways and back alleys of every town, lapping around factories and schools, swarming into office buildings, swirling around the altar of a country church, throbbing in the pipes of a cathedral organ. Freedom. Freedom. Articles of human rights. running like quicksilver through homes, stores, offices, public buildings, city halls, marriage bureaus.
We'd like to apply for a marriage license, please.
All right. Fill out the forms.
Article 16, men and women of full age without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion have the right to marry and to found a family.
Wavelengths of freedom, flashing through the union hall, the courtroom, the polling booth, the hospital, bouncing off the walls of the maternity ward, the nursery.
Article 25, motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. All children, whether born in or out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection.
Vibrations of freedom, fluttering in the wings of the theater, riding down the shaft of light from the film projector in the movie house, weaving around the feet of the ballerina at the opera, harmonizing with the musical instruments as they speak the universal language of the concert hall.
Article 27. Everyone has the right freely to participate in the cultural life of the community, to enjoy the arts.
Signals, cycles, voltages of world conscience, dancing along the radio antenna on your own roof, running like fire through the condensers and tubes of your receiver in your room as you sit and listen at leisure.
Article 24. Everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitation of working hours and periodic holidays with pay.
Ripples spreading around the world from Paris, roiling the quiet waters of Lake Success on the island named for its length, circulating in the conference chambers, the committee rooms, the delegates' lounge, the assembly hall.
Whereas it is essential to promote friendly relations among nations.
The endless transmission, the ceaseless, silent broadcast, the man-made force thousands of times more powerful than the most fearsome bomb. The force that radiates not poison and disintegration, but life and hope, liberty and love. The hard-won, blood-bought, glittering articles of freedom in the simple paper known as...
Document A-777. Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Adopted and proclaimed by the General Assembly of the United Nations. You have been listening to Document A-777. Written, directed, and transcribed by Norman Corwin for United Nations Radio and presented by the Mutual Broadcasting System. The stars of film, radio, and stage who contributed to this broadcast are Richard Basehart, who played the role of Trelawney, Charles Boyer as Zola, Lee J. Cobb as the Swedish officer, Ronald Coleman as Lord Byron, Joan Crawford as Eliza Lynch, Morris Evans as Lord Capulet, Jose Ferrer as Francisco Lopez, Reginald Gardner as de Mandeville, Jean Hersholt as the Swedish itinerant, Lena Horne was the singer, Marsha Hunt as Juliet, Alexander Knox as the contact man, Charles Lawton as Whitman, Sir Lawrence Olivier as the voice of the preamble, Vincent Price as the Indian lawmaker, Edward G. Robinson as the Chinese officer, Robert Ryan as the opening voice, Hilda Vaughn as Lady Capulet, and Emmeline Williams as the Spanish Commandant. Robert Young personified the document, and Van Heflin was your narrator. Lynn Murray composed and directed the original score. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.